Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing Israeli settlements and the ongoing displacement of Palestinians. A new report from B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, focuses on the financial, legal, and planning mechanisms that Israeli authorities have been employing for more than half a century to enable the establishment and expansion of settlements. It says the fact that the West Bank has not been formally annexed does not stop Israel from treating it as if it were its own territory, particularly when it comes to the massive resources Israel invests in developing settlements and establishing infrastructure to serve their residents. This policy has enabled the establishment of more than 280 settlements and outposts, now populated by more than 440,000 Israeli citizens, excluding East Jerusalem. As a result, more than 2 million dunams of Palestinian land have been stolen by official and unofficial means. One dunam equals 1,000 square meters. The West Bank is crisscrossed with roads linking the settlements to one another and to Israel's sovereign territory west of the Green Line, and the area is dotted with Israeli industrial zones. All these have transformed the geography of the West Bank beyond recognition over the decades. In the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, 28 Palestinian families are currently facing forced evictions. Palestinians say this is part of a larger plan to ethnically cleanse them from the land. Last October, an Israeli court ruled in favor of Jewish settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. Palestinian families appealed, and Israel's Supreme Court is expected to hear the case on August 2nd. Yesterday, a number of Palestinian activists posted videos on social media showing settlers throwing rocks at Palestinians outside their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Israeli forces arrived and began attacking Palestinians. Joining us to talk about all of this is Eyal Haruveni, a researcher for B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Their goal is to document human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories and to help create a human rights culture in Israel. Eyal worked on the recent report, This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Hi, Eyal. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for hosting me.
Well, Eyal, before we dive in and talk about the report, can you tell us a little something about yourself? How did you get involved in this work? You've been doing this for a very long time.
Yeah, well, I think my professional experience was a journalist in Jerusalem in a local newspaper during the 90s while Ehud Olmert was the mayor of Jerusalem. And at that time, I became quite familiar with the discrimination and the oppression of East Jerusalem and how Israel, or through the Jerusalem municipality and through the government offices, treating the citizens or the residents of East Jerusalem in a much harsher way that you can think that they would do it, even though Israel claimed that Jerusalem is a united city and all this nonsense. But East Jerusalem is still occupied, and there's a clear distinction between the rights of residents of East Jerusalem, and I guess you probably will hear it much more when you speak with the representative of Sheikh Jarrah and any Israeli citizens like me who lives in West Jerusalem.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Aharia, very close to the Lebanese border. It's a small town near the Mediterranean.
And can you talk a little bit more about the work you do at B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories?
Yeah, we are documenting now for more than 30 years the human rights violations in the occupied territories. But recently we came to a conclusion that this is not something that is totally isolated from the rest of Israel. The same regime that you see in the West Bank or in Gaza Strip is very similar to the regime that Israel has inside Israel in the pre-67 borders. So it's one regime that discriminates Palestinians depending where they are, if they are Israeli citizens, if they live in East Jerusalem and they have residential rights, or if they live in the West Bank, which is under agreements with the Palestinian authorities, but still under Israeli control, or if they live in Gaza Strip, supposedly under the Hamas ruling, but Israel control all every aspect of their life. So in every place that you see the Israeli regime, you see its claim to Jewish supremacy all over the area between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. So we document every human rights and publish reports about these aspects.
The latest report that you did, This Is Ours, and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank, is very extensive. You've got a lot of maps. You have detailed information about settlements. Can you talk about what went into that report?
Well, we are dealing with two aspects of the Israeli settlement policy. First is the incentives and benefits that Israel gives to the settlers and to the settlements themselves. Israel always claimed that the Israeli citizens move voluntarily to live in the occupied territories. But this is a false claim, because Israel built the settlements, Israel built the infrastructures for the settlements, Israel is guarding the settlements, and Israel is giving economic incentives to Israeli citizens to move to the settlements. For example, if you look into ultra-Orthodox families inside Israel, most of them are quite poor. They cannot afford to buy any apartment inside Israel because most of them don't even get a minimum wage inside Israel. So if they will go to the bank and try to get a mortgage for a house inside Israel, most likely they will be kicked out immediately. But if they will buy an apartment in the settlements, they will get the state-subsidized mortgage even if they don't have any economic means. So they can save up to 95% of the value of the apartment if they choose to live in the settlements. So this is a huge incentive for the Orthodox population. In the last 25 years, the largest settlements in the West Bank are ultra-Orthodox. And now about a third of the settlers in the West Bank are ultra-Orthodox. This is one of the incentives. Another incentive is for economic or agricultural initiatives in the settlement or in the outposts, even if the outposts, are, according to the Israeli government, are still considered illegal. But any kind of economic initiative is being supported and being subsidized by the government. And this subsidy is allowing the settlers to expand their settlements all the time. And, of course, they attract the Israeli population to move to the settlement.
In the report, the section about the large ultra-Orthodox settlements in the West Bank, you write that significant tax benefits up to about $60,000 per taxpayer are offered to residents of about 30 settlements. And then you write about land fees and employment subsidies. You write that this drives consistent growth in the number of factories. Israel also encourages people to set up new outposts, which operate as agricultural farms and enable extensive takeover of Palestinian farmland. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, the agricultural farms is the latest phase of the settlement movement. About 40 agricultural farms were built in the last 5 years. All of them are illegal. None of the buildings in these farms have a permit. But all of them are being supported by the Israeli government through the Zionist organization. And the government give them loans to buy herds and to initiate any kind of agricultural initiatives. If they try to have vines, to grow beehives or anything. Anything is being subsidized by the government. Even though they don't live on a land that was approved or allocated to the settlers, even if it's land that is being recognized by the Israeli civil administration, the army body that controls the civil aspects of the occupation as Palestinian private land, they still get subsidized from the Israeli government. And we have seen that this kind of subsidies are a very important tool in grabbing more Palestinian land all over the West Bank. And these are one of the most sophisticated mechanism of the settlement movements. These agricultural lands now control more land than the built-up area of all the settlements in the West Bank.
The report says that in the West Bank, Israel has created several settlement blocks that cut up Palestinian space and dominate vast areas now used exclusively by settlers. It has also built a road system traversing the length and breadth of the West Bank, which serves the settlers and connects the settlement blocks to one another and to communities inside Israel's sovereign territory. Ayel, can you explain what this looks like?
Well, the West Bank is, if compared to the United States, is a very small area. But the settlement blocks are crossing the West Bank from the west to the east or from the north to the south and leaving very small enclaves to the Palestinian communities. So if you see the map of the West Bank, it seems like the Palestinian community are quite small islands within the area that is being controlled by Israel. But this is only part of the picture. This settlement block that we are dealing in this report, only two of them, but there are a few more, are cutting the West Bank from the west to the east. One is south of Jerusalem and south of Bethlehem that goes from the Green Line, which is the Israeli 67 border, almost to the Dead Sea. Another one is also from in the center of the West Bank that goes also from the Green Line, almost from the Green Line until the Jordan Valley. And this has a huge effect on the or impact on the Palestinian community on around them, but also on the any viable opportunity for the Palestinians to have a geographical continuity all over the West Bank. They are sitting on the main roads of the West Bank. They can easily block Palestinian transportation from the south part of the West Bank to East Jerusalem or to the north part of the West Bank. And they are cutting the southern one is cutting the area between Bethlehem to Hebron. The north one is cutting the area between Ramallah and Nablus and Jenin. They are taking more and more Palestinian land. And all of, in all these two settlements blocks, there are massive planning plans to build more and more housing units for the settlers, which will mean much more pressure on the Palestinian communities nearby.
I've seen photos of this, and some of these settlements look like basic suburban developments.
Yeah, they are. If Israel always claimed that the Israeli occupation is temporary, but if you look at these settlements, it's nothing temporary in building a city in the West Bank. They are meant to be there, and there's no Israeli politician even thinks about evicting it. One of these settlements. So they are there for to stay.
And can you talk about the two systems of basic services? You briefly touched on the roads, but what about the water services and other just things that most people don't think about?
Well, in the interim agreement, the Oslo agreement, that Israel and the Palestinian Authority agreed on in 95, that was supposed to be for 5 years only, they were supposed to end in 99. Water was one of the issues that was agreed at that time. It was agreed that it will be one of the core issues that will be discussed toward the final solution. Israel controls all the water resources in the West Bank and allows to the Palestinian Authority to drill in a certain part of the West Bank and sometimes delivers waters to the Palestinian Authority and even to Gaza Strip and also to Jordan. But this kind of mechanism that was agreed at that time, and it's not relevant to our times, promises that Israel will always allocate less water than the Palestinians need and less water than the World Health Organization recommends for daily consumption per capita, which is about 100 liters per day. So in the West Bank, the water consumption per capita per day is about 90 liters per day, while in Israel, it's about 230 liters per day, and it's been growing all the time because Israel has now desalinization projects that are quite efficient and supply most of the water to Israel. In Gaza Strip, it's even less. It's about 80 liters per day per capita. So if you look at the Palestinian, one of the main sources of their economy is the agriculture. Without water, and now with the effects of the climate change, it means that one of the main sources of their economy is always being harmed, and especially in the marginalized community, in the herding communities in the South Hebron Hills or in the Jordan Valley, which don't have any direct connection to the Israeli or even to the Palestinian water network. So they have to buy water that being delivered to them by tanks, and it costs much more than water that Israeli citizens or Israeli settlers are buying from the Israeli water company, sometimes even to 5 times more. And sometimes it's becoming one of half of the family outcome is being spent on water in these communities.
Today we're speaking with Eyal Haruveni, a researcher with B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. Eyal worked on a recent report called This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Today we're talking about Israeli settlements and the displacement of Palestinians. If you have any questions for Eyal, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Eyal, let's talk about what is currently happening in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, which is directly connected to what the recent 11-day bombing in Gaza. And we'll talk about that and give listeners a timeline, because I think that's really important. And a lot of the media coverage in the United States really lacked that context. So 28 Palestinian families are currently facing forced evictions. Can you give us some context about why these 28 families are facing forced evictions from this area?
It's the 28 families in Sheikh Jarrah, but there are many more families also in Silwan, which is another Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem. According to the Israeli law, Jews can claim their property or property that was considered theirs in areas that were occupied by Jordan before 67. Palestinians are not allowed to retrieve their property that was in Israel proper before 67. Many property that was in 48, which if you look at the map of Israel, it's mostly Jaffa, Haifa, Acre, Ramle, Lod, and of course large parts of West Jerusalem. About a third of West Jerusalem is still considered a Palestinian property. So this kind of discriminatory legal system don't allow Palestinians to even claim his own property, even if he has all the legal documents. What happens in Sheikh Jarrah is that some Jewish religious organization bought some lands in the area of Sheikh Jarrah, but didn't build any houses in that part in the 19th century. There are disputes about what are the confines of this area, but no Jews were living in this area before 48. The people of Sheikh Jarrah, some of them are refugees from 48 that had an agreement with the Jordanian government and UNRWA, the UN refugee organization, that they will give up their refugee status and they can build their houses in Sheikh Jarrah. After 67, Israel did not respect this agreement with the Jordanian government. And this religious organization began to claim their own property. And this began a very long legal battle that now it's reaching its climax. And now the settlers, it's not the first time. The first round was in 2009, when the settlers began to take over about 4 houses in Sheikh Jarrah. Now they're claiming 4 more houses and there are many more in that are still waiting to reach that kind of a legal conclusion. So this is a system that really discriminates the Palestinians, and only Jews have the right to claim their property in these areas.
So if we can talk about what happened here, Palestinians have been trying to protect against forced expulsions. And then by mid-May, violence against Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Jerusalem provoked an uprising in the occupied territories and inside Israel. The one question I have is, at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Israeli police fired stun grenades to disperse worshipers. And according to Middle East Eye, this happened over the course of about 4 or 5 days. So what explains that? Why did the soldiers throw sound grenades into the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
There's no... We cannot think about any justification to throw stun grenades inside the mosque or inside the infirmary, inside the mosque, or even to, about the worshippers in the mosque. But it was a series of events that happened during the Ramadan in East Jerusalem. First, the police, without giving any reason until now, forbid the Palestinians to sit in the Damascus Gate or to stay near the Damascus Gate, which is the main place in East Jerusalem where Palestinians can congregate and feel the spirit of the Ramadan holiday. And when the Palestinians tried to congregate in this area, the police used extreme violence against them, using stun grenades, tear gas, beating Palestinians, arresting dozens of Palestinians, and using the skunk, which is the most horrific ammunition that they are using, spraying liquid that is like the sewage of hell all over East Jerusalem. That, with the violence that happened in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the danger of eviction of people in East Jerusalem, provoked all the latest round of violence that we have seen in the last month. But if you think about it, there's no explanation for this kind of violence. In the last Ramadans, the police showed some restraints. There's no real, even if you think about it in the police eyes, why they were doing it, because each kind of police brutality provoked more violence and more opposition by the Palestinians. And the Palestinians in Jerusalem didn't give up on sitting in the Damascus Gate. And it was a civil fight against the brutality of the police. So it seems like something totally stupid and something that, unless there was some political intervention that forced the police to act like it did in Damascus Gate and also in the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Also, according to the Middle East Eye and a number of other reports overseas, rubber-coated metal bullets, tear gas, and smoke grenades were fired at Palestinians at the Damascus Gate, and women with bloody faces were seen being led away by medics. And then what happened, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm putting different pieces together about the timeline. Hamas basically said Israel needs to stop doing this to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and withdraw from Sheikh Jarrah. And Hamas and other armed groups in Gaza then fired rockets at Israel. And Israel responded with heavy bombing. We had some guests on who said that the bombing was heavier than they've seen it in the past. And over the course of 11 days of bombing Gaza, at least 253 Palestinians were killed, including 66 children.
That's correct. I don't know about the kind of ammunition that Israel has used in Gaza, but the timing was right. Hamas gave an ultimatum that you can understand that no Israeli government would accept that ultimatum. But Hamas used that kind of conflict that happened in East Jerusalem to his own benefit, or its own political benefit.
Eyal, we had a number of young Palestinians on the show during the bombing, and almost every email was about Hamas. So what would you say as an Israeli human rights researcher? What would you say about Hamas?
Hamas is a few things. If you think about Hamas is a military organization that rules now Gaza Strip. Hamas is also a religious movement. Hamas is also it's a political movement. And Hamas is putting a challenge to Israel and to the human rights organization, because Hamas doesn't recognize human rights. Hamas is bombing the Israeli civil communities and doing it openly without any reservations. Hamas doesn't respect the human rights of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. But still, Hamas is a political force that Israel has to reckon with.
And who are they? I mean, we throw these words around like the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Hamas. Who are the members of Hamas?
No, they are not the Taliban.
No. I'm saying we throw the words around, but who are these? Who are they?
This is a biggest religious movement that was a opposition to Al-Fatah, the now the ruling Palestinian party in the West Bank. In its first days, Israel supported the Hamas because it thought that it would challenge the Fatah. Hamas took over the Gaza Strip and threw out the Fatah in 2007, and since then we're ruling the Gaza Strip. They are, you can say that they are extremely religious, but still it's a political movement that someday Israel will have to negotiate with.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Eyal Haruveni, a researcher with B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. He worked on a recent report, This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Today, we are talking about Israeli settlements and the ongoing displacement of Palestinians. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org, and you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about Israeli settlements and the ongoing displacement of Palestinians. Eyal Haruveni is a researcher with B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. He worked on a recent report, This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Eyal, earlier in their show, you were talking about people from other parts of the world who move to Israel. And I want to play a clip. Two twins, Muna Al-Kurd and her brother Mohammed, have been getting a lot of attention on social media because they are one of the 28 families facing expulsion in Sheikh Jarrah. Half of her family home was taken over by Israeli settlers in 2009. And on June 6th, Israeli police arrested Muna and her brother Mohammed. After hours of interrogation, they were released. And I just want to play a clip from a piece from Vice's Hind Hassan, who is interviewing Jacob Fauci, who is an American settler from Long Island, New York. And he is the one who moved in to half of the home owned by the Al-Kurds. And here is that clip.
You're a difficult man to get hold of.
Yes, I generally don't interview, but given the circumstances and the bad press that's out there, decided that we need to do some damage control.
Jacob Fauci is an American Israeli. He became infamous after Mona confronted him and the video went viral.
Jacob, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? Why are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are working. Stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yami.
He's been living in an additional part of Mona's house for over 10 years after being recruited by a US-based company called Nahalat Shimon International, which owns the property under Israeli law.
How did you end up here?
It's a long story. Basically, I needed to move from where I was, and my friend was very, very active in this neighborhood, and he said, you can stay here for the time being.
Do you pay rent?
I have an arrangement with the owners of the house. I don't want to get into personal arrangements and rents and things, but yes, I'm a tenant here. I have no ownership over this property.
You're from Brooklyn?
No, I'm from New York, from Long Island.
From New York. What right do you have to live here?
The right I have is that the owner of the house wants me to live here. And he wants there to be Jews living in his house, and he wants to... And I got chosen for whatever reason. It ended up being me.
So why do you live here?
Because I live here, because it's important, and because not too many people want to live here, and it's important to strengthen this neighborhood, to make sure that this neighborhood is not lost in any future peace deal. This is not their ancestral lands. They've not been here for generations. They came here in 1956 because they had nowhere else to be, and somebody illegally put them here. Whatever they're accusing me of is no different from what they're doing and what they did.
So your position here is a political position to keep Palestinians out of it?
Not to keep Palestinians out of it, to keep Jews in it.
And therefore keep the Palestinians who were here out of it?
No. That's a necessary evil. Whatever situation is, and that's what I was trying to explain in that viral video, they're not coming back here. This part of the house for sure is lost. The second part of the house, unless there's some major miracle, is going to be lost. And they're not coming back into here. So whether I am here, whether I am not here, whether it's me, whether it's someone else, whether it's a monkey, whether it's a giraffe, they're not coming back into this house ever. I understand why they're angry at me. I understand why they dislike me. But I did not do this to them. I'm not doing this to them. And as I said, if I leave, I'll be replaced immediately. And I venture to think that whoever comes here is not going to be as easygoing as I am.
That is a clip from a Vice News short documentary called Inside the Battle for Jerusalem. Reporter Hind Hassan got an interview with Jacob Fauci, an American Israeli settler from Long Island, New York. And just to give you a little more background, Mona El-Kurd is a young activist fighting for her home. She says the property was given to her grandmother by the UN in Jordan after her grandmother was expelled from Haifa in 1948. And Jacob Fauci is now living in half of the home. Ayel, when Mona El-Kurd confronted Jacob Fauci and he said, if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it. I mean, this just went viral. Millions of people have watched this clip. How common is this?
In Jerusalem, it's happening since 67. Now, settlers enclave, like the one in Sheikh Jarrah and other parts of East Jerusalem, all of them are on the main roads that leading to the Temple Mount or Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this is the real, if you want to speak about what the settlers want, they are really messianic settlers who are thinking about in some day that Israel, or they will, with the help of the Israeli state, will destroy the Temple Mount and will build the third temple and expel all the Palestinians from East Jerusalem. This is their vision, their political vision, their religious vision. And this is why you can see they are speaking in such open racist language.
What can you tell us about Nahalat Shimon, this U.S.-based settlement company? Vice News said that they would not provide them with an interview.
Well, Nahalat Shimon is built in an area that is called the Tomb of Shimon the Righteous, which is supposedly related to Jewish righteous from the first centuries of the first millennium. But this area was also considered sacred for Muslims for many years. But in the last years, the ultra-Orthodox and the extreme right took control in this area, and they want to build a new neighborhood after they will expel all the Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah that will be for only settlers. They managed to do so in a very close vicinity in the Shepherd Hotel, which is very close by. And they are still trying to take over more and more Palestinian property in this area. So this is one of the settlers' organizations that is working in Jerusalem to expel Palestinians from their homes, in some cases even to buy their properties, and to control the main roads that are leading to the old city.
Ayal Haraveni is a researcher for B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. He worked on their recent report, This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Now I would like to welcome Mohaned Kafisha, a Palestinian journalist and political activist with Youth Against Settlements in Hebron, the second largest city in the West Bank after East Jerusalem. Hi, Mohaned. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for hosting me. I'm really happy to speak to you tonight. It's my time. It's a night time. So thanks for hosting me. It's such a pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you, and thank you for staying up late. Can you just tell us a little bit about the group Youth Against Settlements and the work that you do with them?
Absolutely. So Youth Against Settlements is a Palestinian international group that believes 100% in non-violence. Youth Against Settlements is a non-partisan Palestinian and international group. All our activities and campaigns are non-violent activities and campaigns. Our center is based in the H2 part of the city of Hebron, where this area, the H2 part, forms 20% of the city, where settlements are located near the old city of Hebron and the Ibrahimi Mosque, where there are settlers living here, Israeli illegal settlers living in Hebron, occupying Palestinian houses. So the presence of Youth Against Settlements and the work of Youth Against Settlements is mainly to show the reality of the occupation. But before this, is to strengthen the presence of the Palestinians in the restricted part of H2, because these houses, these families are targeted by the Israeli settlers with the support of the Israeli army and with the help of the Israeli government to dismiss the Palestinians and kick them out of their houses to occupy and make it full settlements within the H2 part of the city. When we talk about 20% of Hebron, we're talking about a very big part of the city. And so our work is to strengthen these Palestinian families with helping them in many ways that we can talk about later. Or I can say that we do a lot of work with them in their houses, because it's impossible to bring people to work in their houses because it's a restricted part. So it is full of checkpoints where Palestinians who live inside are the only people who are allowed in. So our work also is to show the reality of the occupation to the world and raise awareness about what's happening in Palestine. We do a lot of nonviolent work. We start from doing advocacy, working with the human rights organizations, to filming, to working with Palestinian traumatized kids who live in H2, to working with the families, write their personal stories and you know, send it to the world, to working with a lot of international and local media and Israeli media that wanna show the reality of the occupation to the world, to filming what's happening here in Hebron, the attacks and the violations, the human rights violations that happen in the restricted part of H2 and also in Hebron by the Israeli soldiers and settlers. We do a lot of direct action work. We do a lot of talks. All our work is nonviolent. We're believing 100% in nonviolence work. So this is Yas. Yas house is located within the restricted part of H2, which means that we are always receiving attacks and we are becoming an easy target to the Israeli soldiers as Palestinian activists, as also a house of activists, which was attacked so many times by the Israeli settlers. The last time was during the attack on Gaza. They attacked the Palestinian houses in Tel Urmeida, in Shuhada Street, in the restricted part of H2. Also, they attacked our center and threw stones at us. So the presence of Yas is within the H2 part to make the Palestinians and strengthen the Palestinians who are living here to make them stay in their houses and not leave these houses to the settlers so they can occupy them in the future.
Mohammed and Mohamed, it's important to point out that the official ceasefire was reached on May 21st. And at that point, it seems like the camera is mostly left. It's not really getting much attention. The transition, the change in the government got a lot of attention, but Gaza was not even mentioned in most of that coverage. And I'm noticing on social media that there's been a lot of violence since then. Israeli forces and settlers are carrying out forced expulsions in East Jerusalem. And this story got a lot of attention on social media. Israeli police attacked Palestinians on a run. At least 23 people were hurt. This happened on June 4th. The Palestinian Red Crescent said 23 Palestinian runners were injured when Israeli police fired tear gas and stun grenades. This was basically a run in solidarity with families who are facing forced expulsion in East Jerusalem. And one runner, who's pretty well known because he runs around the world, said he got shot in the legs.
I'm 28 years old, and I was born in 1992. So when the second Intifada happened, I was literally, you know, aware of what's happening around me. There is no year that passed from my life without so much violence from the Israeli army and the Israeli government happening against the Palestinians. Every single year. 2000, the second Intifada. 2004, there was crazy riots due to the death of the Palestinian president. Then the 2006 attack, 2008, then 2014. And between these years, it's been crazy. So people around the world will hear about Palestine, and the media will talk about Palestine when it's really bad, when things go really bad, when you would see 200 Palestinians are being killed in Gaza. The ceasefire happened, yes, but the ceasefire happened, and yes, Israel stopped that attack on Gaza that time, but they attacked later. But still, the life of the Palestinians in Gaza is still really bad. Imagine when you need to wait for months to be able to travel. My friend who lives in Gaza, he's a sports commentator. I am also a sports commentator. I'm a Palestinian journalist. He lost a chance for working for the biggest Arab sports channel as a sports commentator because he needed to wait for 3 months. And then he couldn't go out of Gaza to work for this channel. So a dream of a young person who is 20 years old is being destroyed by the occupation because the border was closed for 3 months where you're not allowed to travel. This is a very big pain. It's not only the rockets that are being dropped on Gaza are a big pain for the Palestinians, destroying your dream from the early age that you have, which was your life dream and your future job, was just destroyed because they are closing the border. Palestinian young people in Gaza are desperate. 100% of the young Palestinians are desperate in Gaza. My friend, he plays football. He was playing outside in Oman as a professional football player. He plays for the national team. He could not attend his sister's wedding because the border was closed. It's very big pain. It's water. There is no enough water. Electricity does not come for more than maybe 5 to 6 hours a day in Gaza. And in the West Bank, Sheikh Jarrah, you would see every day settlers attacking Palestinians with the support of the government. So every day there is something happening in Palestine. There is a new violation, a human rights violation by the Israeli army and the Israeli settlers toward the Palestinians. And the world is being silent about it. And nobody hears about it because the media don't really talk about it. Big channels are not talking about it. And when Israel bombed Gaza, or when something very big happens, you would see the media, you know, talking a little bit about it. So people in the US, in the UK, where, in Canada, wherever they are living, in Europe, they hear about us. But they don't hear the full message. The media would say, Israel is bombing Gaza because Gaza bombed Israel. You know, so when the media talk about us, and they're not being fair talking about us. They're not talking about the occupation, but every day there is something happening in Palestine. If you follow the Sheikh Jarrah, Sheikh Jarrah page on Instagram, Mona Kurd, Muhammad Kurd, if you follow people in Silwan, the activists in Silwan, now the activists in Nablus, in Beta, on the mountain of Sbeh, which is threatened to be stolen by the Israeli settlers to build a new settlement. So Palestinians are using non-violence and protesting on the mountain, refusing to leave the mountain every day in Beta. Five Palestinian young people were killed between the age of 16 and 28 just because the army don't want Palestinians to say no to the occupation. So every day there is something happening in the West Bank, Gaza, Jerusalem, even in Palestinian or Arab cities in Israel. We're talking about Lod, Haifa, Jaffa. They were attacked by Israeli settlers, armed settlers from the settlements of the West Bank during the attack on Gaza, after the Kahanists called for the attack, for this attack. And it was supported by the Israeli army and the Israeli settlers. And videos are showing clearly what was happening in Lod, what was happening in Haifa, what was happening in Jaffa. So that's why social media, that's why some radio stations, some TV channels are being good to follow. And especially we talk about social media because it's going viral everywhere. Like Muna Kurd's video up with Jacob, if I don't steal it, somebody else will steal it. It was viral. Why? Because it's showing the reality, and social media could not prevent the video from being all around the world. So I want to say that as a young Palestinian who grew up in Palestine, went to university here, spent 28 of my life here, I've never seen a good time for me as a young Palestinian. And I have never seen a hope for the future happening up, you know, to me, because a good action is happening to my life. I couldn't go to visit and to visit my grandmother's funeral, or I couldn't go to my grandmother's funeral in Jerusalem because they didn't give me a permission. None of my family got a permission to go to Jerusalem. My mom and my dad could go in because they were over 50. But what about me? My uncle, after a few years, died. I couldn't go to his funeral. Between the death of my grandmother and uncle, they gave me a permission during Ramadan. So why didn't you give it to me to go to see my grandmother for the last time? So they gave me the permission to go to Jaffa or to Tel Aviv, spend my money on the beach. They want Palestinians to think only about the beach, not to think about connecting themselves to their family members around Palestine, where I'm not allowed to reach Jerusalem, for example. So they're causing a very big pain to the Palestinians every day by very little actions, like preventing you from going from here, detaining you so you don't go to your exam for your master's, like what happened with Hanad Halawani in Jerusalem. All of these crazy things are happening to us every day. And the world only hear about us, as I said, when it's getting very, very bad, the worst situation.
Mohamed, we're almost out of time. So you're saying if you're under 50 in Hebron, you have to get permission to go to Jerusalem?
Yeah, I can't go to Jerusalem, not even to East Jerusalem, without getting a permission from the Israeli civil administration. And they don't really give Palestinians permissions. If you say no to the occupation, you're blacklisted. If you show an enough reason to get the permission, you don't really get it. It depends on their mood when they want to give you a permission. It was for the first time in my life to see the sea was in Germany, not Palestine, when I traveled to Germany in 2014. I couldn't go to Tel Aviv or to Jaffa. That was in 2014. I was almost 20, 23, 22, you know. So this shows how bad is life here. We don't have an airport. We don't have anything. Our life is controlled completely by the occupation. We can't breathe without the permission of the occupation. This is simply the life of Palestinians in Palestine.
How far is Hebron from the sea?
It's 1 hour and a half driving.
Wow.
I'm 45 minutes away from Gaza.
We're almost out of time. We're going to have another discussion about what needs to change here. But what would you like to add to this? I was watching an interview with your colleague, the executive director of B'Tselem, Haga El-Ad, and he basically said this is not going to stop until we see structural change. What are your thoughts on that? We have about 2 minutes.
unless there will be some pressure on Israel to change its policy and to end the occupation, nothing will change. The occupation is still benefiting Israel. Israel has a free pass by the world to do whatever it wants. There's no pressure on Israel to change its policy, not even from the United States. So what we have seen until now probably can go on for a few more decades. Now we are on the sixth decade of the occupation. It's getting worse and worse, and the worst, the world sees what's going on. Other European countries sometimes say a few things about the Israeli policy. Sometimes the American administration says something about the Israeli policy, but there's no real pressure to change it. And unless there will be some real pressure, nothing will change.
Pressure from the United States and pressure from European countries?
And the world itself, the UN, everyone who can put, who can say something, can do something, can act towards the change of this situation.
And Mohammed, final thoughts from you. We've got about a minute left.
Yeah, I wouldn't add much to what Eyal said. I think Israel would never stop its occupation, end its occupation, until they feel they're paying a very high price for their occupation. Equality will not be achieved here as long as Israel is being supported by a lot of governments around the world, and they're being they're receiving a lot of guns and weapons from a lot of governments around the world. I think the world must support Palestine and the freedom of the Palestinians, because the freedom of Palestinians is part of the human rights that we all believe as humans. And we all deserve the same rights, equality. I would say that there is no equality here. Palestinians are being treated as fifth-class citizenship, and Israelis are being treated as the owners of this land. So as Palestinians, we have, according to the Israeli government's view, we are not existing. We don't exist. So we want the world to help us to force the Israeli government, that Palestinians exist and this is their land, and to have a solution for the future.
Mohammed Kafisha is a Palestinian journalist, sports commentator, and political activist with Youth Against Settlements in Hebron, the second largest city in the West Bank after East Jerusalem. Mohammed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for hosting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Ayal Haravuni is a researcher with B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. He worked on the recent report, This Is Ours and This Too, Israel's Settlement Policy in the West Bank. Ayal, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You can find that report and other stories at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.